Welcome, everybody. So exciting. The beginning of January. And Melody, did I cut you off? Were you going to say something?
Nope, I'm good.
Okay. All right. First of all, welcome back, everybody, after the holidays. We hope that you had a wonderful, fun-filled, family-filled holiday season. And I realize that school has started back up for most of you, and that's also fun after the new year when you've set your sights high to begin again. And Melody and I are really excited to talk to you today and excited about what we're going to share with you. I'm going to start off with three stories to lead into our topic, and some of them I'm going to read. I want to get the details, and I think you'll enjoy what I'm going to read to you. So just, and please, like most often, we ask you to have a paper and pencil with you or your computer to take notes. I hope you once again have that. And with that, this is after I read these stories, I'm going to throw out some questions to Melody. And Melody, I'm just going to shoot them at you, and I just want you to, off the top of your head, respond as quickly as you can, because then I'm going to ask you another question, okay? And I'm just going to ask you a series of a few questions. This isn't necessarily planned, but it will lead Melody and I into our topic for today. Does that sound good, Melody?
Sounds great.
Okay, glad you're always game. All right, this first story is about an airplane. It's an airplane story. On October 30th, 1935, right, at Wright Airfield in Dayton, Ohio, the U.S. Army held a flight competition for airplane manufacturers who were vying to build the military's next-generation long-range bomber. It wasn't supposed to be much of a competition. In early evaluations, the Boeing Corporation's gleaming aluminum alloy model 299 had trounced the designs of both of Martin and Douglas. Boeing's plane could carry five times as many bombs as the Army had requested. It could fly faster than previous bombers, and almost twice as far. A Seattle newspaperman who had glimpsed the plane on a test flight over his city called it the Flying Fortress, and the name stuck. The flight competition, according to the military historian Philip Mellinger, was regarded as a mere formality. The Army planned to order at least 65 of the aircraft. All right, so do you get what's going on? They're going to test an aircraft that the Army already plans on using. A small crowd of Army brass and manufacturing executives watched as the Model 299 test plane taxied onto the runway. It was sleek and impressive, with a 103-foot wingspan and four engines jutting out from the wings. Rather than the usual two, the plane roared down the tarmac, lifted off smoothly, and climbed sharply to 300 feet. Then it stalled, turned on one wing, and crashed in a fiery explosion. Two of the five crew members died, including the pilot, Major Ployer P. Hill. An investigation revealed that nothing mechanical had gone wrong. The crash had been due to pilot error, the report said. Substantially more complex than previous aircraft, the new plane required the pilot to attend to the four engines, each with its own oil fuel mix, the retractable landing gear, the wing flaps, electrical trim tabs that needed adjustment to maintain stability at different airspeeds, and constant speed propellers whose pitch had to be regulated with hydraulic control, among other features. While doing all this, Hill had forgotten to release a new locking mechanism on the elevator and rudder controls. The Boeing model was deemed, as a newspaper put it, too much airplane for one man to fly. The Army declared Douglas's smaller design the winner. Boeing nearly went bankrupt. Still, the Army purchased a few aircraft from Boeing as test planes, and some insiders remained convinced that the aircraft was flyable. So a group of test pilots got together and considered what to do. What they decided not to do was almost as interesting as what they actually did. They did not require Model 299 pilots to undergo longer training. It was hard to imagine having more experience and expertise than Major Hill, who had been their Air Corps chief of flight testing. Instead, they came up with an ingeniously simple approach. They created a pilot's checklist. Its mere existence indicated how far aeronautics had advanced. In the early years of flight, getting an aircraft into the air might have been nerve-wracking, but it was hardly complex. Using a checklist for takeoff would no more have occurred to a pilot than to a driver backing a car out of a garage. But flying this new plane was too complicated to be left to the memory of any one person, however expert. The test pilots made their list simple, brief, and to the point, short enough to fit on an index card, with step-by-step checks for takeoff, flight, landing, and taxiing. It had the kind of stuff that all pilots know to do. They check that the brakes are released, that the instruments are set, that the door and windows are closed, that the elevator controls are unlocked, dumb stuff. You wouldn't think it would make that much difference. But with the checklist in hand, the pilots went on to fly the Model 299 a total of 1.8 million miles without one accident. The Army ultimately ordered almost 13,000 of the aircraft, which it dubbed the B-17. And then I'm just going to end this short part. And because flying the behemoth was now possible, the Army gained a decisive air advantage in the Second World War, enabling its devastating bombing campaign across Nazi Germany. Okay, that's the first story. Now I'm going to read a second story. It was in 2001 at Johns Hopkins Hospital. A critical care specialist named Peter Pronovost decided to give a doctor checklist a try. There's often been nurse checklists. They have checklists for the vital signs. They have checklists for every 6 hours to ask the patient what level of pain they're in. Nurses have quickly, gravitated to a checklist. But doctors haven't done that as fast, okay? So at Johns Hopkins Hospital, this critical care specialist tried to implement a doctor checklist. He didn't even attempt to make the checklist encompass everything that ICU teams might need to do in a day. He designed it to tackle just one of their hundreds of potential tasks, the one that nearly killed Anthony DiFilippo, and it was the central line infections. On a sheet of plain paper, he plotted out the steps to take in order to avoid infections when putting in a central line. Doctors are supposed to, 1, wash their hands with soap, 2, clean the patient's skin with chlorhexidine antiseptic, 3, put sterile drapers over the entire patient, 4, wear a mask, hat, sterile gown, and gloves, and 5, put a sterile dressing over the insertion site once the line is in. Check, 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 check. 5 things. These steps are no-brainers. They've been known and taught for years, so it seems silly to make a checklist for something so obvious. Still, Pronovost asked the nurses in his ICU to observe the doctors for a month as they put lines into patients and record how often they carried out each step. In more than a third of the patients, they skipped at least one. The next month, he and his team persuaded the Johns Hopkins Hospital Administration to authorize nurses to stop doctors if they saw them skipping a step on the checklist. All right. Now I'm going to skip down a little bit. And many nurses aren't sure whether this is their place or whether a given measure is worth confrontation, but now they knew that the administration would back them up. For a year afterward, Pronovost and his colleagues monitored what happened. The results were so dramatic that they weren't sure whether to believe them. The 10-day Lyme infection rate went from 11% to zero. So they followed patients for 15 more months. Only two Lyme infections occurred during the entire period. They calculated that in this one hospital, the checklist had prevented 43 infections and 8 deaths and saved $2 million in costs. This goes on to say a whole bunch of other checklists that they instituted. Okay, I'm going to share one more story. The man that wrote this book that I'm reading to you from, his name is Atul Gawande. He tells about how the checklist saved one of his personal patients. Okay. It was the spring of 2007. I began using checklists in my own operations. I did so not because I thought it was needed, but because I wanted to make sure it was really usable. He says, I did not want to be a hypocrite. We were about to trot this thing out in 8 cities around the world. I had better be using it myself. But in my heart of hearts, if you strapped me down and threatened to take out my appendix without anesthesia unless I told the truth, did I think the checklist would make much of a difference in my cases? In my cases, please. Okay? To my chagrin, however, I have yet to go through a week in surgery without the checklist leading us to catch something we would have missed. Take last week, as I write this, for instance. We had 3 catches in 5 cases. I had a patient who hadn't gotten the antibiotics she should have received before the incision, which is one of our most common catches. The anesthesia team had gotten distracted by the usual vicissitudes. They had trouble finding a good vein for an IV, and one of the monitors was being twitchy. Then the nurse called a timeout for the team to run the before incision check. Has the antibiotic been given within the last 60 minutes? I asked, reading my lines off of a poster, the wall poster. Oh, right. Yes, it will be, the anesthesia resident replied. Okay. So he's going through some of the things, and now he's going to tell one that it completely saved a man's life. He had a surgery to get a tumor off of, it was the adrenal gland. Okay. And, I'm going to share this with you. The man's name was Mr. Hagerman. When Mr. Hagerman came to see me about this strange mass in his right adrenal gland, I felt quite confident about my ability to help him. There is always a risk of serious complications, I explained. The primary danger occurs when you're taking the gland off the vena cava, the main vessel returning blood to the heart, because injuring the vena cava can cause life-threatening bleeding. But the likelihood was low, I reassured him. Once you're in the operating room, however, you either have a complication or you don't. And with him, I did. I was doing the operation, these are nice big words, laparoscopically, freeing the tumor with instruments I observed on a video monitor using a fiber optic camera we put inside Mr. Hagerman. All was going smoothly. I was able to lift the liver up and out of the way. And underneath, I found the soft, tan, yellow mass, like the yolk of a hard-boiled egg. I began dissecting it free of the vena cava, and although doing so was painstaking, it didn't seem unusually difficult. I'd gotten the tumor mostly separated when I did something I'd never done before. I made a tear in the vena cava. This is a catastrophe. I might as well have made a hole directly in Mr. Hagerman's heart. The bleeding that resulted was terrifying. He lost almost his entire volume of blood into his abdomen in about 60 seconds and went into cardiac arrest. I made a huge slashing incision to open his chest and belly as fast and wide as I could. I took his heart in my hand and began compressing it. 1, 2, 3, squeeze. 1, 2, 3, squeeze. To keep his blood flow going to his brain. The resident assisting me held pressure on the vena cava to slow the torrent, but in the grip of my fingers I could feel the heart emptying out. I thought it was over, that we'd never get Mr. Hagerman out of the operating room alive, that I had killed him. but we had run the checklist at the start of the case. When we had come to the part where I was supposed to discuss how much blood loss the team should be prepared for, I said, "I don't expect much blood loss. I've never lost more than 100 cc's. I was confident. I was looking forward to this operation. But I added that the tumor was pressed right up against the vena cava and that significant blood loss remained at least a theoretical concern. The nurse took that as a cue to check that 4 units of packed red cells had been set aside in the blood bank, like they were supposed to be, just in case, as she said. They hadn't been, it turned out. So the blood bank got the 4 units ready. And as a result, from this one step alone, the checklist saved my patient's life. Just as powerful, though, was the effect that the routine of the checklist, the discipline, had on us. Of all the people in the room as we started that operation, the anesthesiologist, the nurse the surgery resident, the scrub nurse, the circulating nurse, the medical student. I had worked with only 2 before, and I knew only the resident well. But as we went around the room introducing ourselves, Atul Gawande, surgeon, Rich Baffert, surgery resident, Sue Marchant, nurse, you could feel the room snapping to attention. We confirmed the patient's name on his ID bracelet, and that we all agreed which adrenal gland was supposed to come out. That one made me remember when a dentist took the wrong tooth out of my daughter's mouth. The anesthesiologist confirmed that he had no critical issues to mention before starting, and so did the nurses. We made sure that the antibiotics were in the patient, the warming blanket was on his body, the inflating boots were on his leg to keep blood clots from developing. We came into the room as strangers, but when the knife hit the skin, we were a team. As a result, when I made the tear and put disaster upon us, everyone kept their head. The circulating nurse called an alarm for extra personnel and got the blood from the blood bank almost instantly. The anesthesiologist began pouring unit after unit into the patient. Forces were marshaled to bring in the additional equipment I requested, to page the vascular surgeon I wanted, to assist the anesthesiologist with obtaining more intravenous access, to keep the blood bank apprised. And together, the team got me and the patient precious time. They ended up transfusing more than 30 units of blood into him. He lost 3 times as much blood as his body contained to begin with. And with our eyes on the monitor tracing his blood pressure and my hand squeezing his heart, it proved enough to keep his circulation going. The vascular surgeon and I had time to work out an effective way to clamp off the vena cava tear. I could feel his heart begin beating on its own again. We were able to put in sutures and close the hole, and Mr. Hagerman survived. Okay. Now, Anality, are you ready? I'm going to ask you some questions. Let's make sure that you're unmuted. Are you there, Anality? Okay, I can't hear Anality. I guess she'll let us know when she gets back, because it says, says she left just a couple minutes ago. So she'll be back in a second. She must have fallen off or something. All right. I'm going to unmute Sherry then. Sherry, press 5-star. And let's see if I can unmute you. Maybe that's not fair. I know other people on this call. Let's see.
I'm here now. Sorry.
Okay. You're here. Okay.
My phone stopped working, so I have to call back in.
On another line. Okay. Uh-huh. I read 3 stories of checklists.
Yeah, I was there.
I know. Okay. And I'm going to ask you a question. We have checklists in our life. Some of them we put together on purpose. Some of them without a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you, just tell me quickly what it is. What is an on-purpose checklist that you and Dawn have created as part of your family path?
For our family, for family path, P-A-S-T-H?
Yeah. Okay. P-A-T-H. Just as a family checklist, something that is vital to your family, something that you and Don have on purpose used?
Well, of course, we have systems that we follow in our family so that we can make sure that scheduling doesn't become a problem. So that's one of our important things, and our checklist there is making sure that we have a planning meeting together as a family, a planning meeting together as a couple every week, and making sure that, of course, we only have one car, so that makes it difficult if we don't
schedule,
you know,
a car.
We have car problems, you know, and making sure that each one of our schedules coordinate so that the car can go to the people who need to have it. And I think, I mean, one of the things that we do as part of that and making sure our schedules don't coincide, you know, clash with each other, is we always, in our planning meeting, have a checklist that we go through. So, you know, checklist inside a checklist. And one of the things that we do is measure is making sure that our family isn't doing so much that it's taking us away from the family all the time. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So we're always
checking. You have a
checklist
of your specific family time.
Right. Mm-hmm. We do.
Okay. Now I'm going to ask you one that's a little bit harder, because I don't know if you've conscientiously planned this checklist. Okay. But off the top of your head, I want you to try and give me one.
Okay.
We talk about seasons a lot, that we, if we look at our life as seasons, then we can learn what our number one, two, and three is appropriately, and then create the system so we can accomplish our most important work at that time in our life.
Yes.
Right? So I'm assuming that you know what season you're in right now, and what your top one, two, three goals and highest priorities are right now for you.
Yes.
Tell me what your checklist is, your weekly checklist that coincides with your season.
Well, my husband and I have a quarterly review on our goals and our seasons. And so the first thing that we do, and we just had this meeting last week, so it's fresh on my mind. So the first thing we do is we review what we call our pies. Our physical, intellectual, emotional, and social goals, I mean spiritual goals. And then we talk about what kind of season that we feel that we're in. Right now my husband is in a riding season. And so he has three goals in his riding, or three things that he's trying to focus on. Obviously he wants to focus on being a good worker at work, which is, you know, something he has to continually keep up. And the second thing is he's working on getting our books. He has a book on Amazon right now, and we're working on some editing for some other books. And, you know, so he goes through that whole thing with me. And then he's trying to get healthier. So that's kind of his season right now.
Of working
the strongest, out. Yeah, the strongest thing that he's doing right now is working on his book, and so that's my his number one, and then he has his two and three.
Okay.
So my number one, what?
Yeah. What about? Tell us about yours.
Okay. So my number one is I'm still in a master's program, and it takes number one and two actually. Because
sometimes that happens.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. Because it is part of what I'm doing is the number two, which is writing, which is part of my master's degree. And then right now my number three is my health again. It's on my list again. So, and we go through
that one.
Yeah, we go through those two checklists quarterly. What's your season?
And you have baby checklists within them. Right?
Yes,
like
within them.
How much water you're drinking, or what you're eating, or how much sleep you're getting, or, right?
That's purposeful, too, actually. It's not purposeful. because my husband and I have that meeting once quarterly, and we have it with each other, and we have it with our children, where they
very good.
They set their pies for the quarter, and they tell us their season. So
very
and
good.
And they're 1, 2, 3.
And that
was an easy one. Do you have a harder one for me?
No, I know.
Actually, I have a really hard one for
follow
you.
Follow our checklist. What?
I have a really hard one for you, okay? I'm going to give you a scenario just to let everyone know. We have not talked about this to each other because we wanted to give, we wanted spontaneity. So I have a scenario for you, and I'm wondering if you could give me your checklist for solving a problem, the scenario. Okay. Theoretically, let's say this has happened, but I think you in your head would have a checklist, okay? So theoretically, let us say that you have a child who's a 5-year-old. Oh, and let's see, you have one of those, right?
Yeah.
That wasn't theoretical. Sorry.
You're fine.
Okay, you have a child who's 5, and he consistently... or she consistently comes to you whining when she wants something. Okay? So it's not just when someone hurts her or him. But when he wants something, he consistently comes to you and whines. Do you have a checklist that would help you solve that problem with that child?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I know what I do and it's consistent. Let's see what the checklist is, right?
Yeah.
I nightly think about, especially if there's a problem with one of my children, I think about the child and I actually think about them. And I ask the question, why is this happening? And
let me ask you this one question. Would you have already had a checklist or already had a way of determining, oh, I understand that this child consistently comes to me and whines when they want something? Do you know what I'm saying? Or would you just be annoyed with the whining?
Well, behaviors like that, then after a couple of times, now I see patterns really fast. I don't know if there's checklists for patterns or it's just a matter of being able to think.
Okay. So you would have seen
it's a pattern.
You would have seen the pattern. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I would have seen the pattern after a couple of times of being annoyed. I would have seen, okay, this is now a pattern. This is not just a couple of times. You know what I'm saying? It's not just
sick.
It's not just because this. It's there's something really real here.
Right.
And I saw it the other day with a relative. They said, we think our child's in a phase. he's being really, really, really mean. And it was really on their minds, and they wouldn't have mentioned it to us. And we hadn't seen them for a couple of years. And I didn't want to offer them any advice. They weren't asking me for advice. But I could see what they were going to do about it. I could see that... they were just going to treat it as a phase. And I knew that I would have done different. Does that make sense? I would have gone through the checklist. I would have, if I answer this, then I'm going to give the whole thing away. Because it is a checklist. We just got to move into things. This totally applies. We have to be more now, Nellie.
Let's answer it, and then we'll go into it, okay?
Okay, well, because I understand human nature, because I understand the development of the child, and that first of all, that every child of mine is going to have their own particular set of vices, and say this one, this child being whiny is not his, then I know it's an out-of-the-ordinary pattern, right?
Right.
Let's pretend. I mean, I could say that it is the child that I do have who is whiny. And even then, it still fits into the checklist.
Okay.
But because, and I understand my child's potential, that my child has every potential to choose not to whine. He has that capability. Or even the one who I do have who does whine has that same capability. I understand the infinite perfectibility of my child. I understand the divine development that can take place. At the same time, I also understand the human nature side of all
right.
of us, which is to take the path of least resistance sometimes and not necessarily do the work that it takes to change.
Yeah.
Okay?
And a five-year-old knows that, by the way. A five-year-old
absolutely.
Totally knows that, yeah. They think
absolutely.
They and they think the path of least resistance is go whine to mom and she'll get me what I want.
Yeah. So the first step is I have immersed myself in humanity. That's my first thing is this, simply this. I love my child, right? Because you and I know my child and I know humanity. You can't love what you don't know. That's honestly the first thing. And then here's the second thing. In the path of wanting to become better, I've had to own that myself. And I always have to do this. This literally, if my child comes whining to me, I ask myself at night, have I been whining? That right there solves 50%. Just going to number two. Just last semester, I had one of my children was was sad. She was just being sad. I'd never seen this particular child of mine really be sad. The only time I'd seen her be this sad was when her cousin was in the hospital last year, and she went through a period of sadness. So she was sad, and when I finally started realizing, okay, this is a bigger deal than I want to think about. And at night, when I went to bed, I was thinking about this. I had to ask myself, number two, am I sad? Am I sad? So the number two one is, I got to own my life. Am I applying the principles of choosing the better part? What am I being? What am I living? It literally solves half of the things that we have to think about. This is, by the way, this is called the mentor's checklist. You can call it the parent's checklist because parents are mentors. You can call it the teacher checklist because teachers are mentors. But this is one way to have a checklist. Okay, you can tweak things, but these have the major nuggets in it. Okay,
and this is to help solve problems. So, I mean, we're specifically talking about some specific problems, but the general rules are going to apply. The general that you need some kind of checklist and
yeah.
So keep going
in your classroom when you're mentoring. That's the second one. So if I theoretically had a child who was whining, and I would say, "Have I been whining?" Let's say for this case that I hadn't been. All right, in my daughter's case where she was sad, and I asked, "Am I sad?" I realized, yes, I am sad. So to fix Melanie, I had to fix me. I had to do the work it took to find out why I was sad and if it was appropriate to continue to be sad or if I needed to step up. Okay?
Because you understand human nature, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
Human nature is that when we are a powerful influence in our home, which all mothers are, I don't care who you are, you're a powerful influence in your home. Our children feel our moods, they feel our intent, they feel our direction.
They feel guilty.
Yeah. And human nature is that you follow other strong humans. You know, I can remember in one of the jobs that I used to work at as a young girl, I worked in a drapery shop, and there was this one girl there that was constantly calling in and calling in sick. And I thought, why is she always calling in sick? Shouldn't I call in sick? And there was a lot of times when I thought to myself, well, she always calls in sick. I should just call in sick. And I realized that it's just human nature to follow those really strong personalities. Yeah.
Yeah. And they don't even have strong personalities. It's just who you spend time with.
Yeah. I mean, it's not my nature to do stuff like that.
Right, but you were tempted.
Yeah, I was very tempted.
Okay.
And, yeah. I think our children don't even know that they're separate from us sometimes. They think they are us.
Yes, especially at certain phases in their life. Well, even in the classroom, if you've got students who, say, aren't turning in their papers, the second part of your checklist as the mentor is to own it yourself. And that means ask, am I writing? I mean,
am I writing? Yes.
Yeah. Yes, you are. So relating this to the classroom, you know, how are my students' attitudes? If you've got a class with a bad attitude, there's a good 80% chance it's a reflection of yours. So this second part on the checklist, if we go through the checklist, it can have us really pinpointing how to solve what's happening really fast if we do the checklist. So literally that's the first thing I ask. If I start seeing a pattern of bad behavior or something, you know, I know the first one, which is, am I loving the person? That's kind of the first one. And am I still immersing? Do I still care about humanity and, you know, those things? And then the second one is I ask myself, and I own it. I own my own life, and I find out if there's a problem in my life, I've got to fix first before I can even start to help the one that I'm loving.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now,
so you would ask yourself,
okay,
am I whining?
Yeah, am I whining? And
okay,
there's been times in my life that has been a thing that's come, and I've had to say, holy cow, yeah, I've been whining. And then you got to stop. You got to decide right there, do I want the whining to continue or do I want to stop? Or you just have to make a choice, right? Okay,
let's say you're not whining. What would be...
I'm not whining. Then you're at the wall. Now you've really hit the wall. And number three, the third thing on the checklist is mind the law of the wall. So this takes your ponder time to a whole new level. You could be thinking about a student who, say you have a student who you know is in a really hard situation at home. Let's say you know that student's parents are fighting. That's a hard situation at home, and you see it coming out in school. You see the behavior that's happening in with the other students. You see what's happening to your student's self-esteem. You see what's happening to the academic work. And this isn't a place that you can't touch. But let's just be really clear here. In the operating room, I think this is so smart. The surgeon says, hi, my name is, and I'm the surgeon. And the nurse says, hi, my name is, and I'm the nurse. And the anesthesiologist says, hi, my name is, and I'm the anesthesiologist. And they go around the room. And they're a team. So let's pretend here we're a team, and the parents say, hi, we're so-and-so, we're the parents. And the teacher says, hi, I'm so-and-so, and I'm one of the mentors. We really are a team. We're more the team than our spiritual eyes sometimes allow us to see, than our natural eyes sometimes allow us to see. But if we put on our spiritual eyes for a minute, we realize that the teacher does know what's going on in the home and can know the parents are really fighting and we're part of a team. And though I can't overstep my bounds and go in and fix their marriage, I know they want me to do everything I can on damage control for their child or on
Can I add something to that whole we're the team?
Yeah.
You know, you may also have a team member that you don't know about that might be causing some of this problem. So maybe you had a grandma who wants to say, hi, I'm grandma, and I want to be part of the team. And if you don't let me part of the team, I'm going to make your life miserable. And, you know, you don't know that that's part of an element that you're working with as a mentor. You know, there's another team member, a silent team member, that's influencing a lot of what's going on. And in the child that you're working with, sometimes you need to know that. Is there another team member here?
That's right. And, you know, and honestly, that goes to the first one, which is to immerse yourself in humanity, because you've got to, the first step is to love and to know. And so the more, and if that's the case, that could be caught in number one of the checklist, which is to know your student.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about one of the students I worked with a couple of years ago who I had no idea that he spent like 60% of his time with his grandmother. And so, I knew the parents, I didn't know the grandmother. Yeah.
You didn't know one of the contributing factors of his behavior.
Right.
Okay. So that's where you're going to catch that one, is to know your student and to know.
When I found out that I had another team member, all of a sudden I was like, oh, I need to be talking to that grandmother, because he spends time there and he needs to be having opportunity to do work at the house. So as soon as I figured that out, I contacted her and said, hey, you know, while he's at your home, could you make sure he's doing this and this? And she's like, oh, yeah, I'm all with that, you know. And from then on, he was handing in his writing.
That's awesome. Okay, so number three is to apply the law of the wall, which means you take the pondering to a whole new level of going to your creator and getting inspiration. So if I have a child who's whining and it's not me, all right, I've gone through the first two steps. Now, the third thing is I seek knowledge that's not my own. You know, I seek understanding. And then the fourth one is say go-be-do. The fourth one is to act on the ideas that come to me and to implement them. I remember one very specifically going through a behavior that wasn't good with one of my kids, and when I took it through this and I did this and the say go-be-do that came, seemingly didn't have anything to do with the problem. There were two cases. It was really interesting. The one with one of my sons, the answer came to tell him a Bible story every night before he went to bed. And it didn't seem to have anything to do, you know, it's that principle that we talk about. Sometimes you have a nail, and with a nail you use a hammer. And sometimes we're treating screws as nails, and we're trying to hit a screw with a hammer when really we just need to twist. In the twisting motions, sometimes we forget there's twisting motions, and that's what this one was. And it really did solve the problem, but it seems really unrelated that when I took it to prayer, the answer was to read a Bible story every night.
Tiffany, I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I have to tell you, so many times people will say to me, I have a son who's probably, if I took him in to have diagnosis, they would say, oh, he's ADHD, which I don't even know what that means, you know, for him, because all I can see is that I have this amazingly brilliant son who can do three things at once. And it's very interesting, because people say to me all the time, well, he's so willful and he hurts people, or he's whatever, you know. You need to get him to stop doing that. And every time I pray about it, every time I get on my knees and talk to God about it, I get answers that seem to not even have anything to do with his direct behavior. Things like have him read a Bible story every day.
Right, it's called precision.
Or have him, or you know, whatever it is. But it doesn't seem to be like have anything to do with it. And my oldest daughter, who has children of her own, watches me parent him, And at first she was like, Mom, you, first of all, you're the only one who has any effect on him. You're the only one who can treat him and ask him to do something and he'll obey you. He doesn't obey anybody else. And she says, and you never raise your voice to him. And I said, yeah, I know the key. I know exactly how to get to him. He has to know you love him first, and then he'll do anything. She's like, oh, my gosh. So what you're saying to me is that I have to get on my knees and humble myself and love my brother. And I said, yeah, if you want him to listen to you.
Isn't that interesting?
So okay. She did it. She did it, and boom, she became one of the ones he listens to.
He would listen to. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's what this is. So the third one is you got to find out what that thing is. What you have to ask, and the ideas come. They really do come if we train ourselves to listen. And then
Four
is action. It's say, go, we do. It's doing the thing. Now, that's the mentor's checklist. There's two other checklists that go along with the checklist that we need to review. When we're doing the pondering of the student during the law of the wall, when we're pondering and praying, or we're seeking, we're going to the Creator, there's a checklist that we have language. This is something that I've realized. I've never been given a Sekobidu that I didn't have some sort of experience with. I don't know how to explain that, but the more versatile we are, the more fine-tuned the answer can come to us. Does that make sense, Melody?
Yeah. This is a very interesting subject to have, conversation to have, because here's what I believe, Tiffany. I believe that you can have... you can be in a spiritual place where you can feel inspired to know how to respond. But if you're humble, it doesn't really matter. If you're humble, and just if you're thinking about, I need to solve this problem, the answers can come to you, whether you find it yourself or it comes through another person. I was just thinking about my daughter again, and how she has a problem with a son who's a little defiant. And, you know, she read a book. She wasn't really paying a lot of attention praying about these kinds of things. It was just something on her mind. And the book just opened up to her. She saw the answer to the problem. It took her four or five weeks of thinking about it, but the thoughts are in the back of her mind, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that some people can get into a spiritual place where they're, you know, boom, I know the answer. Today is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to do, and I'm
right.
going to act
Sometimes
on it.
Sometimes it takes the time. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, so we all have this checklist, and it's amazing how the student checklist is this. We go through, if a student has a roadblock, and it's our job to help give them the right next step, and we have to determine what it is, then the checklist that we have found to be very effective is the vision, mission, ability, and skill. Is it vision? Do they not... going? Is it mission? Is it that they're, do they need to spark the fact that they're of worth and they're worth it? Is it an ability that the reason why they can't accomplish this is because they need to develop an ability? Is that the action they need is a specific ability? Is it a skill? Skills are really important too, and skill drills are really important. And then there is a fifth one, and we've been careful every time we mention this one because it's the one most people usually jump to, and it's actually not the number one answer usually, And that is it a specific piece of knowledge that's missing? And then as soon as they have this piece of knowledge, then everything will open up. I specifically remember once when Anelity was the student and she was going through this, and of course she took responsibility for her own wall, and she followed the law of the wall, and she was asking, where can I get this answer? She'd hit a roadblock in her studies, and the idea came to her just to zip an email off to Oliver DeMille about her roadblock, and she did, and he gave her a little teeny paragraph answer back. And it was
just a little piece of knowledge.
That's all it was. And it unlocked the next, 5 years of study that you've had?
I can't.
It literally.
The thing is, I'll tell you what happened with that experience is it didn't have to be that profound. I could have found the answer, right, if I had done my own studies. But it needed to be that profound, because it needed to be something that I never forgot.
And not just that. I don't know how you would have found it, because you may not have understood its meaning had not the person who'd gone before you told you this is meaningful.
Right.
Oftentimes,
because he gave me
the answer.
Yeah, because
is there
what
before,
he gave
but
me.
In, yeah, until it's pointed
Sorry.
Out as gold, we don't treat it as gold.
Yeah. Yeah, because the answer that he gave me was an interpretation, and basically what he said, he gave me a definition of a word, right? How important is a definition of a word? That was all it was. But he said, this is the significance of that word.
Yes, that's why it happens that way, is because then we understand its significance. If we could get through life on our own, you know, that's where I might disagree with you. Maybe we really don't disagree, but I believe we show each other the specific significances, and it makes all the difference.
Yeah.
It just makes all the difference. Okay, so our student checklist is for our children, for the students in our class, what's their vision, their mission, ability, skills, knowledge. That's what we ask. Do they need any of these things? Now, let's move over into one more checklist. And here's the checklist. Number one, have I done my part? And that consists of the four things on the mentor's checklist. Have I immersed myself in humanity? Do I understand human nature? And do I understand the divine development of each person?
And can I add to that? That we need to understand the paradox of human nature.
Yeah.
And that is that we have a child who can choose good and a child who, and that same child could choose bad.
Yeah.
And if we understand that paradox, it's much easier for us to see the beauty in that child and love them despite their choices.
I really love the great people who talk about, if I responded to a person each time the way they acted, then they would become the dross of the world. But if I responded to someone according to their potential, they're going to become a king.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's the paradox that you're talking about. So that first one, have I done my part? That's the first one. Number one is really you cannot love what you do not know, and love is the key here. And then there's number two, which is owning it, you know, living it yourself. And number three is minding the law of the wall. My goodness, if we forget the law of the wall, we're just really going at it alone. And that's just really wastes a lot of time. And then number four, I say go be do an action, implementing the next right step that we're supposed to implement.
And we can't have one without the other. We have to follow this checklist. This is the right order.
Yep.
Because
okay, now there's one
two,
more.
Sorry, go ahead.
That after that checklist, there's one more piece. If we're considering the student. Well, after number one, then we go through number two, which is vision, mission, ability, skills, and knowledge, the student checklist. We implement that in during three and four. We look at all of those because it always fits in one of those. If I have a daughter, let's take it to the year scenario, who's whining, and I have not been whining, so I know it's not me. And I take my daughter through the checklist. Does she even have, I wish I'd known this checklist when I just first had kids. It could have saved me a lot. I had this one time, the ability and skills part. It's crazy. I had a child whose behavior was, he's only like between 2 and 3 years old, like around 3. And he was calling, I'm going to share this story. I may have shared it before another time. And this is important. This is really important because we usually think everybody's got the ability, all right? And in this case, my son was calling me names, and he was calling me Poo-Poo Mimi. I don't know where he got the potty mouth from because we didn't call names. I owned it. We didn't call names. Nobody, his older brother and sister, did not call names. I don't know how he got those names, but Rick and I had gone through the council. I mean, we talked about it. We had problem solved. We had really trying to solve this, and his counsel to me was, I needed to be more consistent. And I didn't spank him, and I thought, I'm just going to put cayenne pepper on his tongue, and he'll learn not to use that language, right? Well, Rick had counseled me to be more consistent. So this one day, I just remember exactly where I was in my bedroom, leaning on the wall next to my bed, thinking, if I am more consistent, he will have cayenne pepper 13 times by the time we go to breakfast. All right. Now that's getting on the verge of child abuse, right? I'm like, I'm not going to spank him 13 times by the time we go. I'm not going to sit him on timeout 13 times by the time we go to breakfast. I'm not going to give him cayenne pepper 13 times. I'm barking up the wrong tree, right? So I guess finally I did the law of the wall. I mean, I'm looking back in retrospect why it finally got solved. And I'm leaning on my wall and just praying my guts out. What's going on? How can I help my son? What can I do? Why is he calling? Every time he talks to me, and the thought comes to me, but the answer just came so strong, and this was what it was. He is doing the best he can. And I fell to my knees.
So basically the answer was, he doesn't have the ability to do this right now.
Yes. And I started sobbing, and I said, then why in the heck have I been punishing him?
Oh, so how do we help them get the ability?
Well, I know what happened for me, and that is I was filled with a huge measure of love and patience for my son, and never again compared him to the other kids his age. He was always at least 2 years behind in behavior of other kids his age until he reached the age of 8 and he caught up. But for the next 5 years, it changed everything in our life because I couldn't even go to certain social events. I had to stop. I mean, this is real life stuff. I had to stop going to family parties. We got together every Sunday as a family with my extended family, and my son's behavior was so terrible that I had to stop going because it annoyed my dad. And it made everybody really upset around. But I knew something because I followed this and had gotten a Seiko Vudu. I knew my son was doing his best.
And it's so interesting because you were willing to make that sacrifice because you had an extra measure of love for him.
Absolutely.
And
it
willing
paid
to
off.
Make it, yeah, and willing to make the sacrifice pleasantly, happily, you know, not complaining, not upset, not whining. And I think that's the thing that helps me a lot is when I have a child or a student who's not behaving in a manner that other people look on and say, oh, that's really bad. He's not behaving in a manner that's appropriate for me. And I deal with him or that I deal with that child in the way that I know is the right way for that child. Some people look on that and say, wow, that's, what are you doing? Like, you know,
yeah.
Instead of yelling at my son for inappropriate behavior, I send him on errands. Do you know how happy that makes him?
Wow.
Instead of going up, you know, he's in the middle of arguing with his brother, instead of going upstairs and saying, hey, stop that. No, I don't do that anymore because it doesn't do anything. So I go up and instead I say, hey, Zach, I need this. Can you run to the neighbor's house and get that for me?
He becomes
taking him away from the situation, and he's happy to do it. He loves it, and he comes back, and he forgets he was fighting with his brother.
Yeah.
I learned that from Love and Logic.
taking our students through these the checklist, the student checklist, and then knowing the appropriate thing to do about it. Honestly, what you're doing with your son is the exact right thing for him. What
right.
I was doing with my son, I knew we had ability development we had to focus on for years, and I had to be extremely patient.
And people can look on it, the situation, and you can say, and they can say, oh, well, you know, no, you should be correcting them. You should be doing this with them. And you know, you feel completely at peace that what you're doing is right. And you can smile
yeah.
and say, okay, thank you for your input.
Well, I'll tell you part of the rest of this story because it's very, very interesting. He was 3, right, when I realized that we had some major problems because he couldn't do what other 3-year-olds could do. Most other 3-year-olds can learn not to call names, not to call their mom like poo-poo mimi, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah,
that,
I do.
That most 3-year-olds can do that. Most 3-year-olds can ask for what they want and not fall on the floor and scream, right?
Right. You can say to a 3-year-old, if you would like something, you may come to me and say, Mother, I'd like something. And we'll have this script, and you do this, and we'll keep practicing it, and we'll practice it some more.
Right, and we practiced that for 2 years. You know, I mean, just the stuff. Well, here's what's, you know, years later, he's 13, and I'm finally finding out what the problem was back then. But because I understood this checklist, it didn't matter. What I needed to do for the problem was, there's 2 things. There are some things I could have done different had I had the knowledge that I have now that probably could have sped things up, but it may not have developed his character the way that his character has been developed. And I don't know how possible it was for me to have found out back then what I know now, because most experts, even in the field, don't know. And that is, and I'm going to share this on here because there could be, who knows how many of you families need to be linked up to answers like this. And that is that my son is probably profoundly dyslexic. And language was being extremely scrambled in his brain, meaning that he was not hearing what we were saying. And can you imagine going through life having language not have the same meaning as it did for everybody else? Now, there's different.
Wow.
There's 4 different levels of dyslexia. some people don't have the verbal difficulty of being able to put the phonemes together, okay? But it's just the center of the brain that doesn't light up. If a child has dyslexia, then a certain center of the brain, which is an audio center, is the Broca center and the starts with a B or a Y, doesn't light up like it does for everybody else. And they're not using that part, and so some of the message isn't being given the same way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's the good thing. If he's been put in a normal school environment, I can almost guarantee that my son would have no self-esteem or confidence or happiness almost whatsoever. Are you there, Nelody?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just because of his not ability to perform the way that the normal learning environment at public school wants you to perform. And because of,
can you imagine?
Daily humiliation.
Can you imagine how important it was for you to go through this process, going through your checklist in every aspect of his life, right? And how lucky you are that you have mentors in your Commonwealth school who are willing to understand that you're part of this team and education.
We do have to work together. I mean, I didn't have to work with my other two children's mentors in the Commonwealth school near like I have to with his. It's true. I have to call them and say, okay, we're working on this project. Oh, man. He is doing his best, and this is how far we are. What can we do about it?
Yeah.
I mean, I remember one time completely going out of this is what's so cool about TJ Ed. Remember that little caveat that it's supposed to be individualized?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have the plan, you have even the Lemmy continuum, you have all that. I remember I was so excited to put all my kids in Key, Liberty, and Shakespeare, and it came time to put him in, and I didn't know yet about any of the dyslexia. I just knew what he could and couldn't do. I could tell you everywhere he was on every, in math, in this, in all of his abilities. I'm very extremely aware of what all my children can and can't do, right? Parents just are. And I knew he couldn't go to Key Liberty, and I knew he couldn't go to Shakespeare, but I knew he could go to Pyramid Project because of one reason. His sister was in it. And I knew she could interpret for him.
Wow.
Because we all automatically interpret. In public school, if you have a child with an IEP, they can have interpreters. They can have someone go with them from class to class, and when there's like a word they didn't get, it's now going to make it so the next 50 minutes are going to be meaningless. They can look at the interpreter, and the interpreter says blah, 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 and they go, oh, and they stay on. They can keep up. And then 2 minutes later, if another word's used that they don't get, they turn, and the teacher says blah, 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 oh. And say it's a behavior thing where they have an IEP, and they don't call them interpreters. They call them aides, or they just have different names, right? But I knew that he could at least participate at the Commonwealth if he was with his sister, because she could see when he got lost and just lean over and say, did you get that? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. The thing that I have experienced as working with the team, and our Key Liberty teacher probably doesn't even know how we work, how much she's part of our team at our home, you know, because
I can't hear you very well, Anality.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me better now?
There we go.
Okay.
Yeah.
So she gives them she she's awesome about, you know, sticking to the guideline that if you haven't read the book, then you need to not be part of the discussion, you know. And my son has had lots of learning disabilities and just barely started reading a couple of years ago. And reading The Making of George Washington is a huge, huge feat for him. But I allowed him to pay the consequence of not getting the books done when the deadline came. And he took total responsibility that I didn't do it, so I need to have discussion of the books with you, Mom, and when I get the books done, because that's what my teacher tells me to do. And I said, okay, so as soon as you get the book done, come to me and we'll have a discussion. And now this is the first time in the whole, you know, Key of Liberty experience that he's there reading Freedom Factor now, and he literally has kicked his hiney to get that book done because he wants to be part of that discussion.
Wow.
Now, I haven't had to really do anything other than uphold the rule, the guideline that she's given us.
That is awesome. Well, here's your naming number three. Here's the last step of the step of, have I done my part? Have I gone to, so in other words, have I gone through the mentor's checklist? Have I gone through the student's checklist? And then there's one more item on the checklist. And that is, are they choosing to fail of their own agency? And how dare I think of taking that agency away? Basically, respect their agency. Respect their right to fail or succeed.
And respect the right, and respect that they have to pay the consequence for that choice.
Yes. The consequences are really important. Once they choose the failure, if you take the consequence away, dang, man, you're just increasing their consequence for next time.
Right.
If
I had called the Key of Liberty teacher and said, hey, you know, my son, he doesn't read very fast. He's just learning how to read, and, you know, he's going to be way behind these other kids, and these other kids are going to be able to get all this reading done, you know, on time, but he's not. If I'd called and made an excuse for him, you know, so don't hold him to the consequence. He'll have the book 3/4 ready, so let him, you know, sit in on a good discussion. If I had done that for him, I wouldn't see the growth in him that I'm seeing in him right now.
And I think there's a delicate balance there. I think there's time to call in and say, this book is completely above my child's skills level.
Yes.
Can we look at what my child can do? That's where you have to have the spiritual eyes and go through these steps, because sometimes the answer is to switch.
Right.
Does that make sense?
But you need to be on top
and
of that
teacher,
before it happens.
Yes, and the teacher and the parent work together to see that balance, because that is a really fine balance.
Right.
Of is this just the perfect right thing to keep them moving, or is this one of those things that we need to individualize?
You know, Tiffany, this whole checklist thing really reminds me of Covey when he talks about the be proactive.
Yeah.
A lot of his.
Yeah, he's got a checklist, the 7 habits.
Yeah, he does. It just is, you know, dawning on me that we could go through that checklist, his checklist, in our lives and our relationships. And I think that, you know, he talks about not being in the quadrant, the crisis quadrant, but that being in the preventative quadrant as much time as you possibly can. And as we go through these checklists, that's how we are proactive, is we stay in the preventative quadrant. And this checklist that we have, this mentor checklist, the student checklist that we have, are preventative. They're preventative measures.
Right. They're the non-urgent important.
Right.
That's where every one of these. And we hope that each of you listening takes the time to think about what your checklists are, your family checklist, your checklist for particular children, the checklist for the systems in your home, the checklist in your classroom, and remember to use the checklist. I really, this book that my sister just, you know, tossed in my lap and said, this is a pretty good book, you got to look at it. I'm thinking sometimes we need to purposefully put a checklist on the fridge or on our bedroom door.
And chore lists, things like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. These checklists are, look at it. The infection rate went from 11% down to 0. What can we catch in our homes? I'll tell you a checklist that I'm looking at constantly. My brain goes through it every day, every day. This is one of those, not weekly, but every day. And I don't know what to call this checklist, but the way that I visualize it is every window and every door, I have sentinels, because my home is a refuge and a sanctuary from the world. I really, really view my home that way. And I look at how many TVs do I have in my home, how many computers with internet do I have in my home, How many radios do I have in my home? How many ways can the enemy and good things get into my home? Right?
Yeah.
And what is my check? And literally, there we have safeguards. Rick and I don't leave the home and leave the internet on ever. We don't walk because, and we have a checklist that when there's one child at the internet, there's another one next to him. And it's in the, on the family internet in the public place of our house, you know. And we don't leave the home and leave the internet on. You see me? We have precious, precious children in our home, you know.
Right.
And until they gain the ability and show that, that they know how to use it. There's just stuff. I think about the checklists we have.
Yeah.
And we have to ask, what movies are coming into my home? What music is coming into my home? What's my 10-year-old listening to? I mean, so just think about your home. Think about your classroom. Think about your students. Think about those you're mentoring. Think about yourself. And create the checklist you need to have.
Can I mention here something, Tiffany? Do you
know,
sometimes it's difficult for us. You know, something that I'm not very good at is I'm not very good at keeping track of what I'm consuming, what I'm eating. And it's really helpful for me if I always have a mentor that I have to check in with. And so so that I can be held accountable for doing that. There's some people who that just comes really naturally to them. They just know, oh, I've consumed 1,500 calories today, or I've consumed, you know, they're just able to keep track. Some people aren't, like myself. You and I, some of these things that we do as mentors, it comes pretty naturally to us, right? Because it's just something that's part of who we are. To others, it's not doesn't come very naturally. That's why it's if it's something that doesn't come very naturally to you, it's really important for you to have a mentor.
And write it down.
Yeah, write it down.
A lot of,
you know, Tiffany,
you're right.
I will
The mentors are very important. And in this situation with teaching, Anality and I are mentoring. That's what we're doing. You sending in your teacher reports to your Commonwealth, or I don't know who you want to send them to. Send them to your spouse if that's who you want to send them to. Or, you know, we invite you to send them to us. And Melody,
until this becomes a habit.
Important.
Yeah, and you have to understand, Tiffany, you and I talk about stuff like this constantly. This is what we do for a living, you know. And so you and I are always checking up on each other and helping each other be stronger. I mean, even though it's something that becomes is more natural for you and I because we've been doing it for long enough and that we understand the power of it. We've always had honestly, think about it. You know that you're accountable to me and I'm accountable to you sometimes. So
Absolutely. The
accountability really, really helps us. If you are in a space, in a place where you need accountability, it's probably because you need to be we're here for you. Handing those teacher reports, that's accountability. You're gonna get feedback.
Yeah, and your Commonwealth chairman and your the principal mentor, they're there for you.
Yes.
There are the systems in place if we'll just plug in the light, you know, the plug in the plug.
And if you
it's
feel like
there.
You need support in your home with your parents, you can always contact me because I always have a group of parents I'm working with to help them with their systems and their families, their family councils, their mentor meetings. I have a checklist that I go through. We do a 12-week program so that you can get really strong in what you're doing. And I've had lots of success with those people who have joined our that mentoring. So if you feel like, oh, this is just so overwhelming, I can't do this, get a mentor. You can do it.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, we have 5 minutes. We can probably take one or two questions and comments. Does that sound good, Anality?
Yes.
Wonderful. Okay, press. It's 5-star. And then I'll unmute your line if there's someone who has a comment, question, something pertaining to our checklist. Okay. Brooke, I'm going to unmute you.
Hi. I know there was a mini checklist. I think that happened somewhere. So I have
okay,
the first step was, have I done my part? And then the last step was, are they choosing to fail? But I missed, I guess, that.
Okay, the first one is, have I done my part, which means to go through the mentor checklist. The second one is to go through the student checklist, vision, mission, ability, skills, knowledge.
Okay. And that is a mini checklist for one of the...
Your student.
Oh. You mean the 1, 2, 3? This is basically the checklist for progressing on the path, for helping yourself and helping others progress to reach their potential.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, wonderful. We have someone who raised their hand, and their last four digits are 3958.
Hi, this is Kathy.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
My question is along the same lines. I got lost in the checklist, the list of checklists.
Okay. So here we have the potential checklist to help ourselves and others reach their potential. And number
right.
one is to go through the mentors checklist. Number two is to go through the student checklist.
Okay.
Can you need me to review that one?
Yes.
Okay. That is vision, mission, ability, skills, or knowledge. So you say, is my student having a vision problem? Are they even inspired? Do they know where they're headed? Because if that's what it is, then you as the mentor need to work on vision. And you need to you need a vision cast. Is it a mission problem? Do they just have no connection to this work because they don't feel any personal mission right now, no drive? And in
no
that
purpose.
Case, yeah, no purpose. Love is the key there. Sometimes a problem there is going to be a personal vice. When students make really poor choices, it really impacts their connection to their mission. Sometimes there you look at addictions. If you've really got somebody with a really bad problem there, we haven't talked about the checklist for addictions, and maybe sometime Elodie and I can talk about that, because there's a different checklist if you've got a student that actually has an addiction, if you have a loved one who has an addiction, because there are added safeguards for that, and perhaps we can talk about that. But mission, addictions are going to be in every category, because abilities are lost, skills are lost. Vision,
addiction consumes
hit every one of these.
Yeah, addiction consumes their life, and they completely lose the sense of purpose.
Yeah,
okay.
They lose the sense of purpose, and they don't have abilities. They actually are chained. And do not have, if it's a true addiction, they do not have an ability to do better. And that's what addiction means. And so then it, once again, these five things completely are still the answer, but a mentor has to do specific things to help. Okay? So let me go ahead and go on. Then there's ability and skills. Skills are usually things you can do with your hands, like handwriting, that's a skill. Ability is usually something with the character more often, and will. Like, how much focus does that child have? We have some specific abilities that we always ask, which is, do they have abilities to get answers to prayer? Do they have ability to get, say, go-be-do's and follow them? Do they have, just even ability is their ability to do something and their will. There's knowledge. Sometimes it's just a piece of knowledge that we can that they need. So that's the checklist for the student, is to go through those things. How's their vision? What's their connection to their mission? Is it a specific ability that I need to teach this student? Is it a specific skill? Are they ready for that next skill? Or is it a piece of knowledge? And then the third thing on the main list is if they're really choosing to fail, then am I respecting their agency? We have to check ourselves there because it is human nature to force. It is human nature to manipulate and to coerce versus invite, inspire, love, be patient, be kind, be gentle. Those are on opposite ends. And so this third one is a check on us, which is saying, am I going into the force category here? Or am I respecting their agency? And this is a really, really, we have not gone into this majorly, but this is huge. One of the trademarks, not trademarks, but one of the incredible things about most Lemmy mentors is they are learning, because most of us grew up in an educational environment of force. It just was not an option to fail. That there were all sorts of manipulations put on us not to fail. And here we're saying, you know what, this is a totally viable option to respect their agency. And mm-hmm. and at a certain point, once you've gone through list one and list two and you've done your part, you have to say, now am I just supposed to respect their choice? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that's number three is to respect their agency. That's the check on us.
Did that help? Did that help clarify things?
Yes, and then so where does the mining the law of the wall and the Stego be do? Are those four and five?
Okay, those are number one. The mentor's checklist is one: immerse yourself in humanity and your student. Number two: own it. Number three: the law of the wall, and number four: Stego be do.
Got it.
We have two checklists. We have the mentor checklist, the student checklist.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, really three checklists because those are part of the potential checklist, helping someone reach their potential.
Okay.
Maybe we'll type this up and put it out on the Yahoo group. Would you guys like that?
That would be helpful.
Okay. Especially if you're visual like me. On this audio. drive me nuts. Okay. Kathy, thank you. We've got one more person. Let me go ahead and mute you again, Kathy, and then we'll take this other person who has a question. Your phone number ends in 9014.
I was just wondering, you mentioned something about a book. Did you get these stories out of a book?
Yes. The name of the book is The Checklist Manifesto, How to Get
Checklist
Things Right.
Manifesto.
Okay. The author. You'll probably be able to find it from the author. The last name is Gawande, Gawande.
Okay.
A tool.
All right, thank you.
You bet. Okay, and then we've got one more person. Your phone number ends in 6567. Make sure you tell us who you are.
Hi, this is Dawn.
Hi.
Hi. I just kind of had a comment. When you first started talking about checklists, I just was, like, recoiling because I've been spending the last, like, 6 or 8 months trying to get rid of. And it just put me in the mind of this saying from one of my core books that is from a character who is an antichrist, and he says that the way to live this life is to manage the creature. And to me, that's what a checklist is, and it's led to a lot of problems in my life. And so I was really glad, though, that I was able to listen with an open mind because then I realized what you were talking about was a checklist, quote unquote, but it really is a way to tap into the power of your higher power and let him work miracles in your life instead of you trying to create a miracle through a checklist. So,
right. I'm so glad you brought that up, Dion.
Thank you for sharing.
Wow, thank you.
It's,
yes,
it's true, because you're right. If we become automated on it and really run by a checklist and really cut out intuition, that you're right. That's a recipe for mechanical disaster. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it. We have, it looks like we have another person who's raised their hand. Dion, did you have anything else you wanted to add before I? Okay. The next person ends in 8064.
Yeah, my name is Lisa, and I was just wondering, in the mentor checklist, how it, the first step is to know humanity and human nature, and I was just wondering if maybe there was some books that you could lead me to that I could study to help understand that better.
Can I answer
one
that?
One of the most important books you can possibly read on that one is your personal scriptures, your core book. That one is going to help you understand yourself and others. You know, I don't care if what religion you are. Your personal set of scriptures are going to be closer to teaching you about humanity than any other book. And
can I ask what religion you are?
I'm LDS.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to give you a couple of really important books to specifically look at. Obviously, yours is going to be the Book of Mormon. It has human nature all over that entire book. If you're Christian, there's reading the letters that Paul wrote to the people. The letters that Paul wrote is all full of how to correct their human nature.
Okay,
in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm. If you read the writings of Paul, or if you read the Book of Mormon, with the intent of asking God to show to you the human nature in it, you're going to see it everywhere.
You want to see two things in it specifically: human nature and the infinite perfectibility of man, and how to develop.
Yeah,
you know, both.
What you're going to want to look for is the paradox of the carnal nature
the
and the divine
man,
nature.
Both of those combined is human nature.
Yeah, in 2 Peter chapter 1, it gives you the formula. It's a formula that develops the divine man. And you can take that And you could put it juxtapose it to the opposites, and you can see the carnal man and the divine man together in that list. And that list alone will help you really discover. If you do an exercise with that list, that will help you discover.
And that's 2 Peter and Elodie?
2 Peter, chapter 1.
What a good question. I didn't catch your name at the beginning. Who's talking to us?
Teresa?
Oh, Teresa.
What a good question. Thank you so much. Okay, we have one more person. Well, let me see. The number ends in 9288. Okay, now you're unmuted.
Hi, Tiffany. This is Stacy.
Hi.
Hello. I just had a question about the potential checklist. I wondered, it seems like a lot of times, I don't know if it's just me or kind of what I observe in other people to tend to reverse the order. Do you think that's kind of human nature or
reverse order? What do you mean?
Yeah, to kind of look at and say, well, that's just their free agency. They're making that choice rather than, checklist.
Yeah.
Go through the mentor.
Oh, excellent. Excellent point.
What
excellent
a beautiful
point.
Insight.
Can I say that this is something that's definitely a temptation. Thank you so much for bringing that point up because of the world we live in today.
We're taught our brother's keeper.
Yeah, our culture does not in any way teach us that we should have influence over people's choices.
You know, it's scary because when I went to Hungary and saw what happened when one of the greatest tactics of someone like Stalin is to have us be the mimic of our brother's keeper. In other words, they were big brother. They turned each other into the government. When they saw a problem, instead of offering a hand, they offered handcuffs. Okay? And enemies to freedom will often try and turn the culture that way. And if you look in our society, we have an element of that already in our society and the element of, I'm not going to look at my neighbor, but I'm sorry, everything I yearn for, everything deep inside of me wants to connect so badly with my neighbor. If you really think about it, we have this yearning in us, knowing that it's what's going to bring us happiness. And so we all fall into the trap. I remember very specifically, if I could just share this, I got to live in St. George for a year and a half near my family. And I have a lot of close relationships with several of my siblings, and there's one sibling I didn't have a close relationship with. And every time it came to my mind, I didn't know I was doing this. It took me a year to realize I did this. He would come to my mind, and I said to myself, I don't have time for him. He would take so much time. And, you know, time would go by and the thought would come to me again, spend time with this sibling. And this thought would come to me, do something with this sibling or spend time about it. And I'd say, oh my gosh, I don't have time. Well, this went on for a year. Remember, I lived there for almost 2 years. This went on for a year and a half. I had no idea I was going to be moving in 3 months. I thought we were going to stay there for a long time. 3 months before I moved, all of a sudden, this sibling came to my mind, and once again, I rejected it. Are you kidding me? You know, I say to myself, I'm already spending time with this sibling, and I totally said, I do not have time for one more. That's what I said. And literally, Stacy, this came to my mind. I said out loud, am I my brother's keeper? And all of a sudden I went, oh my gosh. And I, of course, that's a very powerful meaning to me because it's part of my core book. And I went back to the meaning of it and I completely knew that I was responsible for my brother and that I had not taken the time. And I immediately acted on that fake obidu and set up a double date with my brother and his wife and set up a follow double date with them and began to give my brother the only gift I have to give anyone, which is my time, you know, my resources, everything I am. And it's now about 6 months after that happened, maybe 7 months after that had happened, and I'm beginning to develop a relationship, and I've moved, and so, of course, it's different now, but still I am doing everything I can, like you said, because we say, do we do it backward? Do we do number three first and say, you know, that's just their right, you know? That's their choice. I'm not going to take responsibility for that. So, Stacey, I'm glad you brought that up. Sometimes we do that.
Thank you for sharing.
Tiffany, can I share something? Thank you, Stacey, so much for bringing that up because I've had a transformational experience in my neighborhood because I stopped saying that.
Yeah.
I stopped saying,
that's their choice. I don't have any influence over that. I would see something that I would think, oh, that brings me a lot of pain, that person's in so much pain, but I can't do anything about it. That's their choice. Actually, it's not true. When we make it a point to be constantly having, I understand human nature.